Welcome to EIR Talks. This week we present the LaRouche Connection, an audio-video news magazine produced by Executive Intelligence Review, which was founded in 1974 by Lyndon H. LaRouche.
As the world enters new depths of the Depression of 2001, with a lunatic Bush administration prepared to save the bank accounts of its greedy cronies at all costs, there is an urgent need for a political victory that will turn the tide in favor of the general welfare, the principle on which the U.S. Constitution is based. Right now, the battle to save D.C. General Hospital, the nation's capital's only public hospital, provides a major opportunity to win that victory. The fight to preserve D.C. General as a full-service, fully funded public hospital has reached a critical stage. Thanks to the activity of an informal coalition of clergy, hospital workers, political activists, and leaders of the LaRouche political movement, there is now a popular mass movement to resist the diktat of the puppet accountant mayor, who himself reports to the control board, the Congress, and Katie Graham's Federal City Council. Support for the hospital is coming in from around the nation and around the world, and an extraordinary congressional briefing was sponsored by Representative John Conyers on March 22nd to explore the matter's national significance. In response to that movement, the D.C. City Council itself took the extraordinary decision April 12th to resist the privatization of D.C. General Hospital.
Health care of our citizens is an issue and a matter that is of great importance to this body. How we provide that type of coverage is also an issue of great importance. And that at this point, the council strongly believes that we are better suited to have a public hospital to be the core of the network of our healthcare system.
So it's a saying that you all think there should be a public hospital in the district.
Yes.
Is that what you mean?
Now, the council's decision may well be vetoed and overridden by the control board itself, a tool of the financial and political elites whose power extends far beyond Washington, D.C. We'll explore the plans of that elite, which presidential pre-candidate Lyndon LaRouche has called Katie Graham's invisible empire, later in this show. The question at hand is to provide a clear picture of how to understand and escalate this fight in the crucial days ahead. We begin with Lyndon LaRouche's response to a question posed to him March 21st by Dr. Abdul Alim Mohammed, a spokesman for the Coalition to Save D.C. General Hospital. Dr. Mohammed had described the progress of the fight so far and asked LaRouche, who was speaking from Europe on an international webcast, how he thought victory could be achieved.
It's almost like a military question. You have this problem is not a simple problem of the hospital. The hospital is a lawful expression. The hospital issue is a lawful expression of a much broader problem. It's like the tiger comes to eat your baby. And the problem is not the tiger coming to eat your baby. The problem is the tiger's been loose in the neighborhood too long. And the tiger is this group of financier interests, which the Katherine Graham and her father's family foundation is a part, which organized in Washington, D.C., a complex of political and financial and legal organizations, which essentially does what these kinds of things do. They run a real estate scam. It may not be called a scam, but it is a scam. And they set up a systemic scam, which will extend over decades. That's how real estate swindles work. They work on decades. They have a plan for the next 20 years we'll do this, and for 10 years after that we'll do this, and we'll sell it today for such and such a price, we'll get such and such a yield on it. It's all worked out. Now, the plan for this Riverside development was part of that. It also goes, again, with the Southern strategy. Everybody knows what D.C. Hospital is. They know what the constituency is. And they wanted them out of Washington, D.C. This is an old story. They want the African Americans out of D.C., or at least greatly reduced, and pushed over into Prince George's County or someplace like that. So it was a deliberate policy. Now, the problem is how you defeat it. When you attack Kathy Graham, you're not doing an injustice, because she is responsible in a key way for the policy structure which is running this. But that's not exactly how it works. She is also the leading figure of an army. Now, you don't eliminate an army by attacking its general. You have to defeat the army. Now, how you defeat the army? You have to destroy its cohesion. You have to drop hand grenades into foxholes and things like that. So what is needed is not to go with the big potato alone. Yes, the overall story, the big scandal is there. What, this swindle on the Southeast, it's there. The role of Graham and her crowd is there. But if you attack those things, you won't win. If you attack them alone. You've got to get at the troops. What are the troops? The troops are a mass of people who have joined the army behind this operation. The troops are little this, little that, this association, that association, political action committees associated with these, which buy into politicians, which buy that, so that you find a nest in the community, as we're seeing in the city government of Washington, D.C., if you can call it a government, since the control board took over. What you're seeing is a complex of people who have each have their little piece of the pie of interest in keeping that cash stream and contributions coming for their candidacies and other projects. So therefore, what you have to do is you have to map out who has joined the army. And you've got to talk to each person, so to speak, in the army and say, you should quit that army. Because otherwise you're guilty of this crime because you are willingly involved in this crime. In other words, you have to disperse the forces, the political force, which stands behind what Katherine Graham nominally heads up and what the Washington Post has stood for. Now, Katherine understands that. She understands that she can back off with an editorial and make a criticism of the policy, but the army is still marching, her army. The army is all of these little people who've got their piece of the pie, including the mayor, who's got a piece of the pie from his political career. His political career was developed in this context. An army has been assembled around a complex of financial power. You attack the financial power and you find the army will come to its defense. So even the army leaders can reduce their exposure, but the army keeps marching forward. Therefore, if you think that you expose the leader and you're going to bring the thing down, you're deluding yourself. The way you defeat an army is by demoralizing the individual soldiers in it or getting them to desert and retreat. And therefore, what you need to do is have more names of the guilty parties, the foot soldiers of the army. You may not get all of them, but you get enough of them to tear the ranks apart. You rout them, and then the leaders are left standing alone, and then they're defeated. That's the way it's done.
As a result of the escalating fight during 2001, KKK Katie's army has begun to splinter. Various lackeys, like Mayor Williams, Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton, Control Board Head Alice Rivlin, and Congressional Neanderthals, like Ernest Istook of Oklahoma, and the Post itself, are on the defensive and fighting with each other to escape blame. But it will take much more to secure victory. The LaRouche movement has been working consistently, actually for decades, to build a movement for the general welfare and as a principle and against Nazi economics, particularly in the healthcare area, where the contrast of principles is excruciatingly clear. We concentrate here on the process from 1996 on, which was a turning point, because it was in that year that President Clinton capitulated to the Southern strategy and the racists in the Democratic Party, and to the Congress, and went with the agenda of Nazi economic measures like the balanced budget, welfare reform, and others. It is from this period that we mark the growth of a movement and the potential for victory today. In the wake of the 1996 presidential campaign, Lyndon LaRouche and his associates formed the FDR Political Action Committee to address such policy issues. The first FDR PAC meeting, held in November 1996 in Washington, D.C., focused on the health issue and included Dr. Muhammad as a key speaker. In his opening remarks, LaRouche described that Nazi economic policies were taking over the United States and outlined what had to be done.
So we are perpetrating Nazi-like mass murder in the healthcare area and related areas in the name of balancing the budget or the name of economy or rationality. And we have people who wish to engage in civil dialogue rather than using harsh, truthful language against this. So therefore, what we've concentrated to make short of this, so we can get on to the speakers, is a group of topics which go to the anxiety, the pain, the suffering, the injustice suffered personally by the greatest number of people in the U.S. population, so that they can understand and see clearly that these policies are not just bad policies by some politicians, but that we as a nation, as a people, must be clear in understanding the axiomatic assumptions which cause us to tolerate, not necessarily to propose, but to tolerate these kinds of mass murder and cruelty. We have to say that we cannot be civil in the sense of not naming names where mass murder is present. Where an American politician proposes a policy of which we find a copy in the indictments and convictions at Nuremberg, that person will be called Nazi-like. And if you don't think of it like that, you're not going to make it. You're not going to change anything. If you don't make that distinction where you make pariahs of mass murderers in similar types and have the citizens recognize what a crime is, then you're not going to get the citizen to mobilize, to force the politician who can be mobilized, you put a fire under his tail, to do the right thing. There are many good politicians, but they tend to be cowardly. They tend to say, well, I've got to go along with what the people want. If the people want us to become Nazis, well, in the interest of democracy, I have to become a Nazi. So that's the point. So if we address these issues, see the reality of the issues, and then ask ourselves, why do our fellow citizens, forget the politicians, why do so many of our fellow citizens tolerate these things that can kill us?
The LaRouche movement kept pursuing this principled fight, of course. We can only present a few excerpts here. For example, in October of 1997, ERR magazine published a feature story on how the D.C. Control Board was threatening to make D.C. mean death camp through the destruction of decent housing, of health care, and the privatization of prisons in particular. In 2000, as part of his presidential campaign, LaRouche held two webcasts on health care, which gathered professionals in Washington and in New York City and elsewhere to discuss the alternative to HMO genocide. LaRouche defined that alternative as the Hill-Burton approach. Then, in April 2000, LaRouche held a town meeting in Washington where he unveiled legislation to ban HMOs and identified resistance to such Nazi-style health care as crucial to rebuilding the citizenry. Let's hear part of that speech.
One of the measures which has to be addressed now, it's the key measure, I think it's the most crucial measure, because it's an acid test of whether we're capable of fixing what's wrong with our national policy, and that is health care. Now, what you probably received a copy of there tonight was a copy of a proposed new piece of legislation for which my campaign and others will be campaigning now. It's a proposal effectively to ban HMOs, eliminate them, and go back to the kind of health care system and policy we had earlier under what was called the Hill-Burton legislation. Now, you can read this bill. You can discuss it. We can explain it and so forth, what it means. The only thing that will solve the problem is to cancel the HMO law, repeal it, end the existence of HMOs, go back to the system we had earlier, a system under the Hill-Burton legislation, which is the post-war system under which we improved health care. We built up hospitals. We maintained emergency rooms in hospitals. Our philosophy was if a person was sick, they were picked up and given the treatment they needed. We worried about who's going to pay the bill second, but we treated them first. We were not going to triage our citizens. We were not going to commit murder. Now, it's even worse. Yes, HMO is worse today. But the purpose from the beginning, in 1973, when that bill was passed, the purpose was to cut the health care of the population. That was its purpose, by privatizing it under shareholder value rules. Now, what's happened today is that's become even more evil. You now notice that the CEOs and the profits of these major healthcare firms, insurance firms, HMO firms, are the highest in their history. You have executives receiving salaries beyond belief for robbing patients of their lives. It's even worse. If you look at an HMO provision, if you're a healthy person in the age group of, say, between 15 and 50, or 15 and 45, with a health expectancy of that life, you may think that the HMO program will give you care. But if you're a person suffering an illness, or a person subject to the kinds of illness which tend to come on at the ages of between 50 and 55, like hysterectomies and things like that, if you're subject to those risks, then you're on a list for elimination. Now, how do they do that? Well, insurance policies are fixed by actuaries. That is, people who calculate the statistical effects of certain kinds of things, certain diseases and so forth, on the population, and what you get will happen to you if you do or do not get the right health care or right medication. What they have done in order to increase the profitability of HMOs for Wall Street sharks is to target African Americans, other groups, senior citizens, and other groups for systematic increases in their death rates, or what are called generally morbidity rates. So there is not only an increase in the death rate is being engineered by HMO policies, but the death rate increase is intentional. An integral part of the policies of the chief executive officers who run the HMO industry. Now, it's even worse. We have precedents for this kind of action. Go back to the 1930s. Adolf Hitler's regime had exactly the same policy. It was called cut out the useless eaters. Eliminate the useless eaters. You target certain groups of people and say, we got too many of them. So reduce their health care. It started in the medical institutions in Germany, among the ill, the mentally ill, other ill people who were incarcerated, hospitalized. Cut them out. Accelerate the death rates. We cannot afford to pay for them. Cut their health care. Get rid of the useless eaters. It was this policy which led to the death camp system in Nazi Germany, especially during the war years. That policy. That policy, that Nazi Hitler policy, is being practiced today in the United States at an accelerating rate.
From this speech, hundreds of thousands of pamphlets were circulated, and discussion intensified in Washington itself, where the Stone Age Republicans had decided in the summertime that the city had to stop funding D.C. General Hospital altogether and privatize the system. By January 2001, with the first round of firings at the hospital imminent, an ad hoc coalition to save the hospital came into being and soon took off. From the outset, LaRouche's associates played a leading role, including providing vital intelligence, like the documentation of the lawsuits which have been filed against the company to which the control board wants to sell DC General Hospital. To give you a flavor of the coalition that is assembled, we turn now to excerpts of town meetings held in Washington January 25th and February 6th of this year. We begin with Dr. Aleem Muhammad, who defined the issue at the January 25th event.
This hospital has been a part of our community since 1806. That's a long time, isn't it? So if it was good enough for all of these years up till now all of a sudden, now what's wrong with it? That it's okay to get rid of it. It services mostly the poor. We got a lot of poor people in Washington, D.C. Have you noticed them? You might be one of them. The District of Columbia, in fact, has 212,000 people who are officially at or near the poverty line. 212,000 people. There's a lot of poor folks around here. And a lot of those poor folks do not have insurance. And when they do not have insurance, and they go to some of the other hospitals, almost any of the other ones, they will not be served. I used to work in the emergency room of Washington Hospital Center. I know that if somebody showed up in that emergency room who did not have insurance, they would try to send them to DC General Hospital. That was the safety net. You can't come here, but there's a place across town, if you can make it, called DC General Hospital. Well, now where will those people go if DC General Hospital does no longer exist?
At the January 26th meeting, an aide to Councilman Kevin Chavis made the following statement.
The council member would want me to indicate to you that he continues steadfastly in the fight that hospital will not close. Dr. Muhammad knows this better than anybody in this room probably, except for Dr. Newton perhaps. If that hospital closes, many of our brothers and sisters and children would die on the streets.
That's right.
It's as simple as that.
Absolutely.
If that hospital closes, many of our children, mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers, will die on the street.
At the February 6th meeting, political activist Alice Dennis reported on lobbying she and others had done on Capitol Hill.
And I told them yesterday, it is murder in the street not to have health care available for the citizens, the tax-paying citizens of the district. We are treated as second-class citizens. And the other thing, yes, we can go to the mayor, we can go to the council, but my friends, we need to go to the Hill. That's where the decisions are being made.
Kenneth Lyons, whom you see here, is an emergency medical technician in D.C. Speaking on February 6th, he was very direct.
I don't know how to say it other than this is your day of reckoning. There will be no tomorrow if the hospital is downsized in any way, shape, or form. I like to start off all when I speak to people about this. It's somewhat strange in that just yesterday we had a contingency of people, concerned citizens, and we went to Capitol Hill to lobby a couple of congressmen. And while there, it struck me as odd as that they thought this was just a citizen problem, just a city problem, just specific to a certain sector of the city. But when we explained to them that in this city, at any given time during the day, there's 1.5 million people here, not just from the nation, but from all over the world. And in being a paramedic in this system, we've taken patients from all over the world to DC General Hospital. So it's not only a city problem, it's not only a national problem, It's a worldwide problem. And as soon as they recognized that, they said, oh, well, you know, that's rather strange. We didn't know that. Let me tell you a quick story, and I say this just to emphasize just how important this hospital is. Just several weeks ago, an individual was shot 3 blocks from DC General Hospital. 3 blocks. Because the maintenance crew wasn't available and the generators couldn't open the doors, the hospital had closed. That 16-year-old male was transported 3 blocks from that hospital to MedStar. He died on the ramp. I don't know how many of you have children, whether you have sons or daughters, but in this young man's case, it was wrong place at the wrong time. And how many of you can say that that'll never happen to you? It's the success of any city to care for its weak, its injured, its young, and its old. It's called compassion. That's what separates us from the wild. And I have to tell you now, this city is showing no compassion. And without compassion, there's no hope. And in this case, that's what DC General represents. It represents both compassion and it represents hope. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your day of reckoning. Mine too. As Calvin said, we are selfish in EMS. The name of our game is to save lives, regardless of who they are, what color they are, where they're from. You don't get many more days like this. Don't take this day for granted. There are people that are quite happy in keeping the truth from you. Well, fortunately, you know the truth. Act on it. Be active. Be persistent. Because, again, I think you represent that hope. And without you here tonight, if you have sons and daughters, they will suffer if you're not active in this fight. The only plan here is to keep the hospital available as a full-service facility. And I don't know what other plan there is. But whatever plan that they may put up on the blackboard to illustrate how successful the hospital will be other than keeping it full-service, I tell you, it's a lie. It's not even a wolf in sheep's clothing because it's transparent.
You're listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with the LaRouche Connection, produced by Executive Intelligence Review.
Also taking a leading role in the fight is Reverend Clarence Turner. Turner's sister was one of the first victims of recent budget cuts at DC General Hospital.
I'm the only one living, but my baby sister did not have to die. Now somebody would say it was DC General's fault. Somebody would say this, that, and the other. But the biggest problems that happened was because of the silly budgetary cuts and some doctors that were so busy trying to save money that they didn't deal with her situation. She was sent home, and in an hour and a half to 2 hours, she was dead. Now, you look at me and you say, well, how did it affect you? You know, I knew my sister was born again. When she left the service that Sunday morning, she told me plain and simple. She said, Butch, I've got this thing all worked out. You don't say that if you don't know the Lord. You know, because a lot of people want to check out, but they don't want to check out right away for the simple reason. You know, wait a minute. If I check out, where am I going? Well, you don't say you got it worked out unless you know where you're going when you check out. Now, see, I've had many experiences. I know what death is all about. In 59, they lost me a few times. I've seen the flames. I've seen the Y'all might not be able to handle that. I better leave that alone. But you go on over Revelation and look up at about the second death. I checked that out already. But when God got in my spirit and touched me, then I realized that a change had to take place. The change had to happen in me. Our change has to happen in our system. Our system is set up for you to die. But I'm telling you right now, when I told you about the kingdom suffering violence, that violence is coming from principalities, powers of wickedness in high places. And some of them are stepping into the very system. Now, if they snatch D.C. General Hospital out there, what do you think they're going to put in there? High rises and beachfront condominiums and properties. They can still put those condominiums and beachfront properties in there, but there's some people who are going to die in the process. How many are you willing to die because somebody wants to make a few extra $1 million? She died because somebody, somewhere, not only got lazy, not only did not care about blacks and Hispanics, whomever gets forced to go to that hospital. You see, because if you get hurt out in my area, the first thing the ambulance has to do is to take you to D.C. General. The same crew that delivered her had not even gotten off their shift, came back to announce her dead. Can you imagine why? Somebody wants you dead too. I can put somebody else where you are that makes a whole lot more money than you, pays a whole lot more taxes than you do. Matter of fact, might even smell better than you do.
And then there's Reverend Mildred King, who is organizing phone banks, demonstrations, and publicity.
I'm going to take you way back just a moment. All of us ain't been saved all of our lives. And we went to some parties late at night, and it was cold outside. Raining, snowing, but we got to the party. It's now time to party at the White House in peace. So I want you to come out of comfort zone.
Providing the national and international focus, however, are the leaders of the LaRouche movement. Here we show Lynn Speed, who has been an active organizer with the movement, speaking at the conclusion of the February 6th event.
And we, as a citizenry, nationwide, because this is not a local problem, the nation's capital, every nation in the world, the capital is a symbol of pride. People look at that as a representation of how the nation treats all of its citizens. So what does it mean that we have a situation here which is a national shame? 500,000 people in the city, there's 1.5 million visitors every day in the city. What happens if they're hit by a car, if they're shot, if they have a trauma near the Capitol? This is a concern of every single person in our nation and in the world. And in Washington, D.C., this should be a model.
Since February 6th, however, the movement has grown in scope and depth. Increasingly, those involved understand that the issue is the choice between the general welfare and genocide.
At a recent discussion with economist Lyndon LaRouche, between myself, my husband, Dr. Aleem, there were several national state legislators there, about D.C. General. Mr. LaRouche stated that if the policy exemplified by the proposed shutdown of D.C. General was not reversed, that you could see a catastrophic collapse in human population globally down to the levels of 1 to 2 billion people. Now, you all figure that one out. The international financial oligarchy and key policymakers in Congress and other places are fully conscious and in some cases explicit on this fact. And I want to read you some quotes in their own words, a little history you need to know. The first is from a man by the name of Thomas Malthus, who was a paid writer for the British East India Company in the 19th century in enforcing a policy against the colonies of Britain. Malthus says, quote, "Instead of recommending cleanliness to the poor, we should encourage contrary habits. In our towns, we should make the streets narrower, crowd more people into the houses, and court the return of the plague." In the country, we should deliberately build our villages near stagnant ponds and encourage unwholesome situations. But above all, we should reprobate specific remedies for ravaging diseases and restrain those benevolent but much mistaken men who have thought that they are doing a service to mankind by protecting schemes for the total extirpation of particular disorders. Then to bring you up to a more recent spokesman, Prince Philip, as quoted in the press in 1988, "In the event that I am reborn, I would like to return as a deadly virus in order to contribute something to solve the overpopulation problem." And finally, since a lot has been said to us over the past several months about balancing the budget, this is from Michael Novak, "The Spirit of Democratic Capitalism." "Every newborn child," he says, "lowers the average per capita income." So I think this is pretty clear. We are today at a crossroads. Either our nation will go the way of Germany in 1933 under the Nazis and lead the world into the abyss, or we will readopt a commitment to the principle of the general welfare as stated in the preamble of the U.S. Constitution. This was the content of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. It was the content of Dr. Martin Luther King's civil rights movement, and it is what we are fighting for today with our movement. Now, many of you here will recall that on Wednesday evening, I raised this issue to Mayor Williams of the Constitution mandate to protect the general welfare as the only basis for the authority of government. Nowhere in the Constitution does it say a word about fiscal responsibility and balancing the budget over the backs and at the expense of the lives of the citizenry. In fact, the latter is exactly what the Nazis did, and it is what is being proposed with the shutdown of DC General, the only public hospital in our nation's capital today. It is a genocide policy. Now, the mayor, while saying he appreciated my passion, took offense at the use of the term Nazi, and he stated we should be very careful when we use that term. And I say emphatically now to the mayor and the press that the term Nazi is being used by us extremely carefully and extremely precisely. And I think we are going to demonstrate to you this afternoon with the presentation of various speakers not only the accuracy of the comparison between 1932 and 1945, but that what is now occurring with the collapse of health care here in the district, nationally and globally, may be 100 times worse than Hitler. Yes. Now, a crucial metric by which we can judge the truth or falseness of our ideas is the metric of population, population density, and life expectancy. We can measure how successful the human race is at reproducing itself. And it is only our species. Animals can't do this. They don't have the cognitive capability to do this, to deliberately, self-consciously increase our population and increase our longevity and increase our quality of life. So in the last 150 years, what you have seen is a phenomenal rise. This first graph is population, population density, number of people per square mile, and life expectancy. And you see this shooting up over the last 150 years where we have gone since World War II, for example, in the U.S. and in the advanced sector from about 60 years longevity into the mid-80s. And my great aunt died a couple of years ago at just a few weeks short of her 100th birthday. And she was in a public hospital. in New York City. So this has, but in the last 3 years, from 1997 to 2000, the average lifespan for the entire human race, not just black people, not just Asians, not just a few people somewhere, the entire human race life expectancy has begun to fall. Now, this is the first time that this has happened since the Black Plague in the 1400s. 600 years. Zambia and Zimbabwe, the life expectancy is now down to 33 and 34 years of age. Those are the conditions which are to be imposed on the district with the balanced budget policy unless we are prepared to fight. We have a health catastrophe in this nation right now. It's one of the worst in the world in the advanced set. Infant mortality, one of the key markers, and I think Dr. Young, a pediatrician here at DC General, is going to speak to this in a moment. But this has been driven down, particularly since the mid-1970s, where you had a Malthusian policy, a zero growth policy, beginning to replace the idea of Hill-Burton, which was brought in under Roosevelt. Hill-Burton was very simply that you had to have a certain number of health professionals and hospitals per population. And they built hospitals, thousands of hospitals across the country in a short period of time, together with improving the nutritional level, the living standard, the life expectancy, the population increased as a result of that. But this has now been exactly the opposite. It speaks for itself. Hospital beds per population, and you can see it going up and then the catastrophic decline across the country. And at the same time that's happening, the number of uninsured Americans, as the HMOs have been brought in, the number of uninsured Americans is actually skyrocketing. So you think by shutting down the public hospitals and setting up a series of private clinics that people are going to have more of an insurance of getting health care, or are they going to have, in fact, less? I like to show this one because I'm from New York. So this is hospitals in Manhattan, 1960. Look at what's happened. It's like a strategic bombing survey. The hospitals wiped out, particularly in the poor communities. So this is our dots in contrast to those of Dr. Ivan Walks. Now, this is my last graphic. What this is the hospitals in the district. But we just didn't want to show the wipeout of the hospitals. We wanted to show you another process which has been underfoot, which is the losing of hospital beds and sections of the medical facility. Because you can have a building, and that doesn't make it a hospital. When you lay off 1,250 people, you're not going to have a hospital no matter what you call it. The district has lost 42% of its beds, 2,700 beds since 1995. Every single hospital in this district is strained to its absolute capacity, and you shut down DC General, you may push the whole health system of this district right out of the window. Some of the cuts. Look at Veterans Hospital, 56%. Howard University, 23%. Walker Reed, 56%, and so forth and so on. But then just take a look at the map. Here is Hadley Hospital down here, shut down by the doctors group that wants to take over DC General. Capitol Hill Hospital closed. So, and St. Elizabeth's, this is a psychiatric hospital, they threatened to shut that down. And here's Greater Southeast that's already had cutbacks.
But look at this whole area. And we're talking about traveling times, and a few people might bleed to death. Well, I'll tell you something. It is already happening. We have the broadsheet that we've printed out. We've been distributing it. It has a list on the back of some of the, on the front rather, known or should have known. These are some of the victims just of the cutbacks which have occurred since the beginning of this year. There may be others. These are the ones that we could find out about. If you have more information, you should contact us. So it is only through a national fight to return to the principle of the general welfare against Nazi slaveholder values that can reverse this.
In addition, LaRouche's EIR has begun to uncover the secret power structure in D.C., which is implementing this genocide. Our final clip is of EIR editor Ed Spanas making a presentation on the Negro removal plan of KKK Katy Graham's Invisible Empire at an April 10th meeting at Howard University.
In 1976, a fellow named Roger Starr, and remember that name because you're going to be hearing a lot about him, he was a big muckety-muck planner. He ran the HDA, I think it was called the Housing and Development Administration in New York City. He was on the Regional Planning Commission, these bodies and so forth. And he's a banker's man. I think he's still around. He wrote an article in 1976, which was in the New York Times Sunday Magazine, and many of us who go back that far remember it well. It was called Making New York City Smaller. And what he talked about was reducing the population of New York City from 7.5 million, whatever it was then, down to about 5 million. And the way that he said that New York City can no longer support the population it used to have. This used to be a manufacturing center that people don't think, even in that period already by 1976, didn't think of New York City as manufacturing, but that's what it used to be, right? Largely the needle trades, apparel, a garment center, printing, all kinds of things. As D.C. had some, much less always, but New York was really that way. But that ended by the mid-1960s. So he said it's going to become a different kind of city, finance, business, tourism, this kind of thing. But we cannot support the level of public services that we've been used to. So we got to reduce the population. We got to cut the cost of services. But the way we're going to do it is reduce the population by reducing the level of services. And he called for closing down fire stations, police stations, hospitals, transportation, closing subway stops, all these types of things in slum areas, to drive the people out. And then he said, what we're going to do is we're going to concentrate people in other areas, and we're going to level certain areas. And he says, after we shut the services down, the people have to move, we'll go in, and I'm not making this up, this is all in this article, we're going to level these areas, bulldoze them, and let them sit there for maybe a couple decades till somebody decides to do something else with these. And he describes, and this is pretty accurate, he says, when I was denounced as a genocidal lunatic and an enemy of man when I first proposed this, rightfully, I think we would add, that the Black and Puerto Rican caucus of the city council adopted a resolution of condemnation of him. He was picketed and so forth. Our associates did an interview with him in 1981, 5 years after he wrote this article. And what he said then was, he said, the number one problem is the poor. If there's anything that has me completely buffaloed, it's what to do with the underclass. Or he says, what Pat Moynihan, remember him, Mr. Benign Neglect, right? What Pat Moynihan talks about is the underclass. I know what we did with them 100 years ago. We gave them tuberculosis. And this is what the man said. He said, some of us thought they had found a way to extinguish themselves with drugs. More recently, drugs were going to get rid of them. But unfortunately, it hasn't happened on a large enough scale to achieve what I'm talking about. So they are not a disappearing minority. But this echoes what Lynn quoted from Malthus and Prince Charles and these people. I mean, this is what the guy said. Another thing that Roger Starr describes in here is resettlement. He says, well, under the New Deal in the 1930s, we had a policy of moving people you know, from the farms, into cities, or moving them into areas where there was manufacturing jobs because of the Dust Belt, the poverty in the South, and so on. Now, they did many other things. They built up a lot of the South through the Tennessee Valley Authority. They brought electricity, they brought power, and they made it possible to industrialize these areas. But what Roger Starr ignores that, he says, well, maybe we should have a resettlement policy also. That's harder to do, but a policy in which we can move people out of the cities into other areas. Now, in fact, we do have such a policy today. Like, I was just meeting this morning with somebody on the Hill who has been involved with D.C. and was describing this voucher program under the Section 8 housing where they actually pay people to move out of the district. And if you have a voucher, or certified for a voucher here and live either in public housing or in a private housing, the Section 8, if you want to move out to PG County or Arlington or Alexandria, now they're also paying people to move further out. You can get paid federal government payments to move out of D.C., right? And that's part of the plan, the plan. Now, federal city council, which Charlene mentioned. This is Catherine Graham's, Katie Graham and her critter company and her invisible empire. And her invisible empire works through this group called the Federal City Council, which is not a government organization. It's not a federal government. It's not the city government. It's above, right, the city government. And in many respects, they probably think they're above the federal government either. These are the banking, real estate, business interests for D.C., but in fact, not just for D.C., because in fact, they have national interests involved in this thing as well. This was created in 1954 by Philip Graham of the Washington Post, Catherine Graham's late husband, who she had something to do with making him late, apparently. But he created this thing in 1954. It was modeled, and they said, our task, we're creating this to combat urban blight, as they called it, to promote redevelopment and renewal of the district. Right? You might call it the bleaching of the district, because this is what they had in mind, the bleaching of Chocolate City. They modeled it on a project that had taken place in Pittsburgh starting in 1943, which was the slum clearance or Negro removal in Pittsburgh, and which ran through something called the Allegheny Conference, financed by Richard King Mellon, the Mellon family, and the Hillman family there. And these were the people, they ran this project successfully there, not just removing the population, but also removing most of the industry out of Pittsburgh, which happened to work well for the Mellon family because a lot of their factories were outside the city limits, so they shut down everything in the city. And then they brought in to head this thing in 1954, the guy who had run the so-called slum clearance in Baltimore up to that time, and he became the executive director of the Federal City Council. The first project they undertook was the so-called Southwest Urban Renewal Project. This is backwards. Huh? There you go. Which now is this area here, right, called Waterside, I think, and this, if you go from South Capitol, and I did this the other day, just went across M Street, where they're doing a lot of rebuilding after Navy Yard, and as soon as you get over in here, all of a sudden, you're in middle-income housing, luxury housing, fancy restaurants, yachts, marinas, all this stuff along here, and then L'Enfant Plaza. And this was the first big urban renewal, Negro removal project in D.C. was the Southwest Project. And that was the first thing the Federal City Council did, and very proud of it. Who was on this thing, I mean, the Washington Post is sort of preeminently. They have the most seats on this of anybody. Then you have major banks, of which there aren't that many left here in the district anymore, but Riggs Bank, Chevy Chase on it. You have the major real estate developers. You used to have the department stores, Wanamaker's and Garfinkel's. These things aren't around anymore either. So now it's heavily concentrated with sports, Abe Pollin, the people running the sports, real estate developers, banking interests. And then for window dressing, they put on the five university presidents, including the president of this university, and a lot of other people But you got some of these people are important, and some of them are window dressing, right? And you got to sort of figure out which people are which in this thing. But this is the group that runs it. And you talk to anybody who's been involved in urban planning, urban renewal, this stuff in D.C., they say this is where the power is, that the city government just does what they're told to do by them. The National Capital Planning Commission, which is supposed to be federal government also, they send from the federal, I was told, the federal level, they send sort of lower level people in, and the city people and the federal city council people come in and can really dictate the policies on that thing too. They were the ones responsible for the convention center, MCI center, the freeways, the metro, the subway system, all this stuff. And when they decide to do something, they just push it through. They go to Capitol Hill, they go to the city government, and they say, this is what's going to be done. And you can find, you know, if you dig through newspapers and magazines, you can find various places where they're bragging about the fact that this is what they do. They decide to do it, and they just get it done. They don't do it with a lot of fanfare. They don't do it with a lot of publicity. And these are the people, ultimately, who are behind the shutdown of D.C. General, right? Because they've got a plan for the city.
This, then, is the issue. Whether KKK Katie Graham's invisible empire and her program for genocidal Negro removal is going to prevail, or will our citizens succeed in imposing the constitutional commitment to the general welfare on which our nation was founded? The outcome will determine not just the future of D.C., but your future. Will you join us?
You've been listening to EII Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.